This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Hong Kong is a global commercial hub, and right now protesters are hitting it where it hurts, the airport. Flights are grounded there now as Hong Kong tries to get a chaotic, sometimes violent protest movement under control. It's been going on basically nonstop since residents pushed back against a proposed extradition policy. Now the world is worried about how long this will last. China is watching closely, too. Hong Kong is just the first of two big global stories we'll explore this hour. Later, we'll shift to Russia and talk about a nuclear explosion there that has many people concerned. We welcome your questions and thoughts on either story. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us from the BBC is NPR's London correspondent Frank Langfitt. He formerly was based in Shanghai, and he's the author of The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank, welcome to 1A.
Glad to be here.
Joining us in studio is Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is a bipartisan think tank based here in D.C. He is its trustee and chair of Chinese Business and Economics. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
Frank Langfitt, let me start with you. What's the picture right now in Hong Kong?
Well, actually, what it seems has happened is there has been a court injunction to actually get the keep the protesters out, and flights have begun to fly again. And what has happened is the protesters, as they've shown over the weeks, is they do a lot of these hit-and-run kind of protests where they will seize an area and then they will melt back away. And that's what they've done again today. They've sort of disappeared. There are some protesters at the airport, but things are getting back to normal after, as you described, really a very tumultuous day yesterday with a lot of violence, and it got pretty ugly.
Can you describe who the main actors are in this conflict? You know, who are these protesters and who is it they're pushing back against?
Well, the protesters, a lot of them are young Hong Kong folk who are very upset about the extradition treaty, that the extradition law that Hong Kong government was trying to put together. And the reason for that, Joshua, is they were very afraid that it would be used for political purposes, that people in Hong Kong, who, which of course enjoys a lot of autonomy and a lot of freedom and a mostly free press, that they might be pulled into mainland China, into a court system that's run by the Communist Party, and punished for doing things like speaking out their mind and criticizing the Communist Party. So that was the big thing. But it's much bigger now in terms of what's driving people. They would like to see democracy. There's also a huge income gap in Hong Kong, as there are in many major cities around the world. And many of these young kids don't think they'll ever be able to own homes. And so there's a lot of boiling frustration. And of course, they're up really against the Hong Kong government, which is largely seems beholden to the Communist Party, which doesn't want to see all this happening and wants to basically get a much tighter grip on Hong Kong.
So that's kind of what we've been hearing from folks in Hong Kong. What about from people in mainland China? How is the average everyday mainland Chinese resident talking about this or reflecting on all this?
Yeah, Joshua, this is fascinating. The Communist Party, I think, has done a very good job of framing this in a certain way, that these protesters in Hong Kong are troublemakers, they're becoming very violent, and certainly there is video to show that, and that they're spoiled, and that basically some of them are just sort of heading this city into disaster. So there is not a lot of sympathy among many mainland Chinese, in part because of the diet they're getting from a very well-constructed propaganda program by the Chinese Communist Party. And I've been in touch with people just in the last day. And one of my friends in Shanghai was telling me that even if you're sympathetic towards people, the protesters in Hong Kong, you don't dare say it because people are very angry and you're afraid the kind of pushback that you would get.
So we know that this all kind of touched off because of this extradition bill and the fear that it would basically allow for more political crackdown in Hong Kong on behalf of mainland China, kind of by extension. Scott Kennedy, can you tell us what sparked the actual protests that we've been seeing? Was there a last straw in a way?
Originally, when the extradition amendments were submitted in February, it wasn't street protesters. Actually, it was business that first was critical. And that's very different from the umbrella movement of 2014, when there was a big difference between the protesters on the streets and business people. Now they were aligned. But the protesters then came out in April when it looked like this bill was going to go forward, and we got, you know, 1 million to 2 million people on the streets. The numbers are lower now, but the views are still the same. The fears that Frank point to about declining autonomy and challenges to their way of life are still there. And then you've seen a very bad reaction on part of the government, very non-sympathetic, patronizing language from Carrie Lam, the chief executive, and then mistreatment of some of the protesters in the subway. And so that has generated additional backlash, and that's why this isn't resolved.
And we should be clear, the way, Scott, that this bill was at least promoted or explained is that it wasn't just for like scooping up whoever mainland China said, oh yeah, bring us that person. It was more for people, as it was initially explained, like, you know, if a murder suspect crossed from mainland China into Hong Kong, that person could be extradited. That at least was the argument, right?
Sure, yes. And in fact, actually, the original case that prompted this reconsideration involved a Hong Konger who was in Taiwan, not in mainland China. So it's supposed to apply beyond that. But because there was this firewall between Hong Kong's legal system and China's, intentionally placed as part of the handover and the maintenance of this one country, two systems approach, which gives Hong Kongers the sense of protection and safeness, even while being part of China, they push back.
Elaborate on that a bit, Scott, that one country, two systems relationship. How much of what's happening now can be kind of traced back to that history?
Sure.
This feels like it's very much of a piece with that.
Yeah, well, we really need to go back to 1984 when Margaret Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping, China's leader at that time, signed the joint declaration in which they promised Hong Kong would be returned to Chinese sovereignty in 1997. The only way really to reassure Great Britain and the West that Hong Kong wouldn't be immediately gobbled up and its successful system destroyed is that the Chinese said it can keep its system. We'll have one country, but two systems. It'll have its social system, economic system, rule of law continued. And that was then inculcated into the basic law that governs Hong Kong's life. And everyone, you know, when 1997 came, some Hong Kongers did move to Vancouver and other places, but most stayed, and they thought 50 years is a long way. It's basically a promise forever. And what we've seen over the last 22 years is that the shadow of the future, the arrival of 2047, is basically now feels like it's at the doorstep, and the protesters and people in Hong Kong feel like they don't have any time anymore.
We're speaking to Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and NPR's Frank Langfitt. Now, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, is very much in the middle of all this, kind of caught in the middle of all this. She held a press conference yesterday about the unrest in the city, and she kind of evaded a question about that extradition bill that we mentioned that sparked all of these protests. Here is part of what Chief Executive Lam said, or perhaps didn't say.
The central government is still confident that I myself, as the government of the Hong Kong SAR, together with the police force, that we are still capable of resolving this crisis.
Do so you have the autonomy or not to withdraw the extradition
point,
bill,
the second
please?
Point I want to make.
Could you answer that
in response
specific
to
question?
The various demands that we have heard, we have considered all factors. Thank you very
Do
much.
Do you have the autonomy or not to withdraw the extradition
she
bill?
Has answered your question. Please.
You have not answered the question. You've Sorry. Evaded the question.
Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, dealing with some questions at a press conference yesterday. Scott, what is the answer? Does she have the autonomy to withdraw that extradition bill without Beijing's say-so?
Absolutely not. The way the Hong Kong system is really set up now, the chief executive and all the officials around her spend all their time looking up to Beijing or meeting with officials in Shenzhen to get guidance. They don't look down. Hong Kong's got a partial democracy for its legislature. The chief executive is chosen through a handpicked election committee, which chose her, and so she doesn't. And obviously she has mishandled this. Her language has been inappropriate and not sensitive, but she's really a puppet And if you change the chief executive, you're going to get the same thing unless the rules of the game are changed.
So we should be clear. This extradition bill came from Beijing or came from within Hong Kong?
I think it came from within Hong Kong, them reading the tea leaves, and they would have done it in consultation. But once it was introduced and once they've gone down this road, they're not going to back up, because from Beijing's perspective, backing up isn't a sign of confidence. It's a sign of weakness.
Frank Langford, what is it that the protesters want? Have their demands evolved since these demonstrations started, or have they been pretty consistent?
They have. I mean, one thing is they want this bill to be completely killed and never, ever come back. And she won't do that, in part because, as Scott points out very well, she doesn't have the power to, which is sort of fundamental to the problem here. You have the chief executive of this very successful city, wealthy city, who doesn't have the political power to actually represent their interests. So there's a fundamental political problem here. And then in terms of their demands, they're now asking for direct democracy. They want to be able, exactly coming back to Scott's point, they want to be able to elect a chief executive themselves who will represent them. And it's clear that Carrie Lam doesn't. And so I think that that's the crux of the problem. And also, I think on the front, there's been a lot of violence, particularly from the police towards the protesters, and they want that to be investigated.
Yeah, the idea of direct democracy gets to what Sharon wrote on our Facebook page. Sharon writes, "My husband and I moved to Hong Kong in April 1989. What was supposed to be a two-year stay turned into 16 years. We witnessed a lot of history being made in that time. Watching young students fight for more democratic systems was inspirational. What would a democratic China mean? On the morning of June 5th, 1989, we woke to the sound of wailing in the streets, the haunting sounds of so many people learning of the violent crackdown against peaceful protests in Tiananmen Square will never leave my memory." We will continue with what the future of all this might look like with NPR's Frank Langford and with Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We'll talk Russia in just a few minutes. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the recent unrest in Hong Kong and the protests at its international airport with NPR London correspondent Frank Langfitt, formerly Shanghai correspondent, and Scott Kennedy, the trustee and chair of Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We'd love to hear your questions about what's been happening in Hong Kong or with that nuclear explosion in Russia, which we'll talk about momentarily. So comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A at WAMU.org. Frank and Scott, I'd love to get your thoughts on this comment from Sharon from our Facebook page. Let me read it one more time. Sharon wrote, "My husband and I moved to Hong Kong in April 1989. What was supposed to be a two-year stay turned into 16 years. We witnessed a lot of history being made in that time. Watching young students fight for more democratic systems was inspirational. What would a democratic China mean? On the morning of June 5th, 1989, we woke to the sound of wailing in the streets, the haunting sounds of so many people learning of the violent crackdown against peaceful protests in Tiananmen Square will never leave my memory." Scott Kennedy, let me start with you. That Tiananmen Square throwback, you know, just 30 years ago, is it possible that this could turn into another Tiananmen Square where Xi Jinping, the president of China, might say, "Okay, that's it. We got to move down and move in and stop this"?
It's possible. It's still not inevitable, though. I think the Chinese learned some from Tiananmen. First of all, in the type of tools you use against the protesters when you're facing off with them. The second, and so they've tried to use non-lethal force so far, and they've prepared, if they have to, going forward, water cannons, et cetera, if they need to. In addition, they're trying to get the local government, the Hong Kong government, to be the bad guy here, which is what they do in Chinese cities around the rest of the country. But if it does come to that, I don't think there's no place in Hong Kong where you're going to be clearing a square like that and using that kind of force. It would be much messier. I think the Chinese also are going to think twice and hopefully thrice about this, because Hong Kong's economy is only 3% of China's GDP, but it's much more important than that in terms of its relationship with the West. I think pacifying Hong Kongers is going to be super hard, because they are really westernized and globalized. They aren't going to accept the Communist Party coming down and sitting on top of them. And then lastly, if you thought the Panama Papers had a lot of information about corrupt officials, think about all the information that is available about Chinese officials who have used Hong Kong banks, financial institutions, real estate there. It'd be a big risk for them to do this because of the threat of information, which could threaten their legitimacy.
Frank Langford, with regards to the possibility of a democratic China, I saw some video on Twitter this morning of protesters in Hong Kong waving American flags and singing the national anthem. I mean, I kind of wonder about that, because the prospect of it, for me as an outsider so far away, feels remote. I mean, Joseph commented on our Facebook page, "I don't think this will end well. In the end, China won't care about world opinion, and if they feel they have to, they'll use military force to end the rebellion. Can't have the mainland getting ideas that they're allowed to defy the party." Frank?
Well, Joshua, your observations are dead on. It's very, very remote. And that, I think, is a very small concern of the party right now, because, as you can see, actually mainland opinion, by and large, is with the party on this. They don't feel a kinship towards these folks in Hong Kong. So, no, I don't think that's very likely. To Scott's point, you know, sending in, and it would probably be, if they were going to send anybody, it would be the People's Armed Police that were created after Tiananmen, so as not to have, you know, soldiers who are not trained in riot control coming into cities like this. But I think he's exactly right that this would be the absolute last resort for the economic reasons, the political reasons. It's not going to be like trying to pacify a mainland city where everybody's grown up under authoritarianism. And honestly, the idea of seeing armored personnel carriers in amidst the high rises of Hong Kong, these, you know, glistening skyscrapers, and the inevitable Molotov cocktails. I mean, the visuals would be terrible. And how do you do it? So I think what China's going to try to do is wait them out again, as they did in 2014, which I covered the Occupy movement, and hope that the kind of episodes we've seen at the airport, which were genuinely ugly and bad, and which the protesters have apologized for, that kind of seeps away some of the public support for Hong Kong protesters in Hong Kong.
Well, Frank, I was going to ask you about that. In terms of these protests at the airport, has that been a turning point in the conflict at all, or is it just kind of another episode in an ongoing drama?
I think it's some of the worst that we've seen. And I think that I was really frightened, frankly, is, you know, there were two mainland people who were beaten, one of whom worked with Global Times, which is a very nationalistic mainland publication, state-run publication that's been criticizing the protesters. But there was a moment where a protester took a baton from a cop, started beating him, and the cop drew his pistol inside the airport. Simply, if that pistol had gone off in the Hong Kong airport, I mean, that is a new – things would be very different, let alone if a protester had been shot. So I think that it's a very dangerous time right now, because things can spiral out of control, and then you get very strong feelings among the protesters, but certainly among the many mainland Chinese who don't like what they're seeing in Hong Kong.
Several of you have been asking questions about where all this goes from here and kind of suggesting what you would like to see. David commented on our Facebook page, "I find the numbers of people protesting staggering. It is literally a quarter of the population. I truly hope this is the start of a cascade of civil unrest that will finally take down China's one-party government." Scott Kennedy, could you speak to David's comment? Is it actually a quarter of Hong Kong?
I think the numbers people can debate, but there was somewhere around 1 to 2 million at the peak, 20-ish percent of the population, something like that. In the U.S., that would be a protest of somewhere around 50-plus million people on the streets.
And Hong Kong's population is just over 7 million people.
Yes, that's right. So it's basically everybody. This isn't a small group. It's the public speaking up essentially with a single voice wanting to protect autonomy. But I think we need to adjust our expectations. We're going to have to be comfortable living in a world that isn't ideal. We're not going to get democratization. What we can get is some protection of the autonomy. I think Hong Kong, the protesters themselves need to be more realistic about what they can achieve. And they also need to realize that, as Frank knows, the life of folks in Hong Kong is very different than in any other Chinese city. There's no party, Communist Party organization. You have full access to the internet, full freedoms of daily life. And living in China, just going across the border into Shenzhen, is different. And so they need to realize that there is a way of life still to protect.
There's also been some questions in terms of who else around the world might be exerting influence. That gets to what Jack left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Jack. I'm calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. And I was just curious about the thoughts surrounding the United States' influence in Hong Kong regarding the pro-democracy protesters and whether or not perhaps the U.S. could be wielding a bit more power or influence if we weren't in a trade war. I guess I just wonder if we hadn't created the current climate of relationships with China, could we be doing more to support what are pro-democracy protests?
Jack, interesting question. Thank you for sharing that with us. Frank Langfitt, what would you say to Jack?
Well, I think it would be interesting to hear. The president has been kind of ambiguous or ambivalent in the things that he's tweeted about this, so we don't quite know exactly what he thinks. And that's where a president can have a really big influence. Of course, we know the president of the United States is very transactional, and things like freedom of speech is not necessarily the top of his priority. In terms of in Hong Kong, it's probably best that the United States officials stay out of it, because there was an official who met with some of the protest organizers and leaders, and this was photographed and then was beamed back to the mainland as, look, the United States is behind this. They were apparently talking about something quite different, or concerns that Hong Kong folks had about things that were being sold into Hong Kong. But I think it'd be interesting to see what Congress says. We certainly heard a fair bit from Congress, and they do have a way of exerting pressure on China if they want to.
Before we move on and talk Russia, Scott, how do you see this being resolved? Is it most likely, you think, that the mainland Chinese government's just going to let this kind of peter out, maybe the way that the Occupy movement was just kind of allowed to do its thing and then end? Or does China get more involved? What do you see as most likely?
They could try that. I think there may be some exhaustion on the part of the protesters. I think there needs to be some sign of good faith from the Hong Kong government, whether it's about formally withdrawing the bill or engaging in some type of negotiation and meetings, that they are not only listening, but that these people have a voice that is heard and a role. I think those things would help. I sympathize with Jack. I was a student at University of Virginia in the summer of 1989, watching what was going on in Beijing then, worried, and then we saw what happened. I hope that we don't repeat that here. All sides need to step back. I don't think the U.S. can speak up, but I don't think at the end of the day it has a huge amount of leverage, because these are really the life and death for the Communist Party, and critical for and Hong Kong. So I think this is going to be decided by all of those who are in China, in mainland China, and down in Hong Kong.
Scott Kennedy, trustee and chair of Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Scott, thanks for talking to us.
Sure.
And NPR London correspondent Frank Langfitt, author of The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank, thank you.
Happy to do it, Joshua.